An unpainted still life, a composite of identity, faith, and aspirations. Horizontal, a surface of heirlooms, something valuable, something cheap, a collection of reliquaries, votives, and trinkets. Being both the center of ritual and an empty space, carrying and holding belief, made active only with intention.
Welcome to episode 3 of A Common Craft. That was Radhika Apte reading The Voice of the Altar. In light of current events, I'd like to wish you all good health and happiness whilst we isolate ourselves from our usual daily rituals, and I hope this next hour or so can nurture some curiosity and calm. This episode is loosely based on objects, their makers and custodians, as well as how witchcraft appears visually in the world. I talked to artist Leon Sadler about mischief, lad culture and honouring yourself, Simon Costin about being custodian of the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic, and Sabbat Magazine's Elizabeth Crone about teenage witches and the publication's success. As always, I want to stress that not everyone I talk to identifies as a witch, but they offer ways of seeing, making and being that align with its archetype, and with its beauty, its struggle and its power.
A lot of people really confuse witchcraft or Wicca, pagan religions, with devil worship. They feel that it's evil, that we're harming people, that we're putting spells over people without, you know, consulting them, and we're really not coming from that space at all.
In command. I'm the quintessential queen of sorcery. I keep a potion in my purse that's worse than any curse. No, you wouldn't want to mess with me. Take a barracuda's nose and a dozen turtle toes and the venom of a sea anemone. I have urgent crab of Louis, stir the goop until it's gooey. That's my favorite rancid recipe. No, you wouldn't want to mess with me.
Hiya.
Hi, Leon.
I don't know what I can say. My name is Leon Sadler. I am 35 years old. I have a part-time job at a museum and I make stuff the rest of the time. I make comic books and I publish comic books and I make zines. At the moment, I'm printing onto clothes and making accessories. And I'm making sculptures, and I'm exhibiting in galleries, and I'm putting my stuff in shops, and I'm selling things online, and I'm swapping things with people, and I'm collaborating with people.
For some reason, I saw a kinship in some conversations that we have had about making and maybe magic in terms of creativity. Or how you are in the world. If you're interested in magic, let's say, and everybody keeps asking me about, oh, you do the podcast and, you know, now you're out as a witch. That hasn't happened yet. I haven't had my outing as a witch yet. Mm. And it's something which the podcast is still allowing me to explore, how I feel about my personal connection to my belief systems and how I want to exist in the world.
Mm.
And then the creative one, because previously I would make work about witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
Now that doesn't interest me at all.
Mm-hmm.
I feel I live it every day now.
Yeah,
it fulfills me in a very different way. And I wondered if there was anything in that that you found.
I think, like, I've strongly had this idea of, like, Nen, this aura that surrounds things. We were watching, there was this anime show that we love called Hunter x Hunter. There was this moment where these characters go to an auction and they're auctioning off, like, artifacts that have, like, this aura called Nen, and they're, like, the most powerful Nen objects in history or whatever. And I think it just, like, really neatly describes that, like, unexplainable thing. Like, you just... sometimes something's just so good. It's beyond, like, explanation. It's beyond words. You just, like, it just, like, resonates. And I don't know, like that's something that people can, like, make those things happen. And I guess, like, yeah, like, that's my ultimate goal, is, like, charge things with, like, good Nen. And, like, I'll judge what I'm doing and I'll be like, this does not, the Nen is weak. Or, like, this, yeah, this has got good Nen. And it's often, like, simple things. Maybe that's not right. But, like, yeah, that, like, aura. But I don't know. I think witchcraft is about also, like, setting up, like, a potential for something to happen, or addressing, like, putting, like, these conditions or something. So you create conditions for, like, stuff to, like, unfold or whatever. Yeah. Making, putting yourself in a situation where things are going to, like, effortlessly materialise and be like, good. Yeah, I don't know. When have you noticed it?
Yeah, people have asked me how have I picked people for the podcast? Because not everybody identifies as a witch. I mean, barely half the people. And I guess because for me it seems so everyday, that kind of magic. I think aesthetically, the creation of the worlds, the visual worlds that I see that surround you, have their own kind of magic, and they have their own systems in them, and they have their own characters that exist all together in this world that seems full of, like, magic potential, but also mischievous potential and kind of dark potential as well. It's very, I think I've always found your work very enlightening, but it's also very aware of some kind of darkness as well, which I find compelling, really compelling. It's interesting what you said about your how you present yourself in the world, how you choose to present yourself in the world, and your work being very different, because I sort of see them as the same thing. I just see you in the world and I see what you make in the world as the same things. Yeah, that, not to say that I don't think your work's autobiographical at all. It's not that. Have you ever thought about the archetype of the witch, or of the kind of... the witch as a marginalised being?
I think...
that has empowered you or helped, or...
I think more like the goblin. More the goblin. More like the idea of, like, a kind of a mischievous critter... humanoid, detached and kind of like behind the trees or something. What is it about it? Little mischievous thing, and it just feels like so, just like a symbolic, what was it, archetype. I don't know what's so powerful about it, but it's like, it's really independent and it's really like and you can't really affect it or whatever, like it just does its own thing and it's got its like energy, like it's like constantly mischievous, like it's mischievous without like any like loss of appetite or something, just like more and more like much mischief and like I don't know, like curiosity and it's like innocent as well, and they're like I don't know, I guess like yeah, the archetype of a goblin I think is like yeah, it's without there's like darkness coming out of it, but it's not like malicious, it's just like very natural and like very, maybe that's the condition of it, like being like a marginalized entity, it's not like a welcome creature or something.
The cabin was cozy and hollyhocks grew bright by the door till his whisper crept through. The sun on the sill was yellow and warm till she lifted the latch for a man or a storm. Now the cabin falls to the winter wind and the walls cave in where they kissed and sinned and the long white rain sweeps clean the room like a white-haired witch with a long straw broom. Now the long white rain sweeps clean the room like a white-haired witch with a long straw broom like a white-haired
I don't know, do you want to talk about Loughborough? Mm. Was that getting off subject?
No, let's talk about it. We can talk about it.
I guess in terms of like being an outsider.
Yeah.
Just like the small town just does not have a place. I realised like, I think I was thinking before this podcast and I've not thought back to my upbringing. I never like relate things to like my childhood or like teenage years very much. I don't want to like give them too much credit for like who I am. But I realised, like, I used to dress pretty weird when I was a teenager. Like, as soon as I didn't have to wear a uniform anymore, I was, like, in the loft getting my mum and dad's old stuff from the 70s out and combining shit and, like, sewing things. And I didn't know what punk was, but I knew it had something to do with, like, safety pins and, like, exposed, like, sewing, stitching. And, like, straight away went fully, like, into, like, dressing however I wanted. And I realised, like, I didn't get too much grief because I was so used to just keeping my head down and stuff, and like you just have like a bit of a defense mechanism so you don't notice people being horrible. But like actually I didn't know anyone else doing that. My younger brother Steph, he was like, I think we were just influencing each other and we were like pretty happy just to wear whatever. But we were the only, I didn't know anyone else who like dressed like me. That was like the height of lad culture. The most like, I don't know, like so counter, so different to the world it is now.
Mm.
Like in our formative years, like it was so like violently misogynistic, like to everyone. You were like either with it or you were gonna be like annihilated by it. Like I don't know, it was just like so violent in like, not in terms of like people, well it was very aggressive, but like that psychic violence was like just like off the scale mental. And I only just like, I've wondered why it's taken me so long to kind of like acknowledge and accept myself, because those formative years or whatever were so aggressively straight and homophobic. I never was like wanting to show people like, this is who I am, look how individual I am, look how different I am, look how unique I am. It was never driven by that, and to the point where I didn't know how to make it clear that like I wasn't trying to make a statement or like trying to show people this is how it should be or whatever. I think I was just completely unwilling to hide myself or something. Like I was completely unwilling to be squashed by that stuff in relation to like cross-dressing or being non-binary. Like the world was just so different. And yeah, that's why I would come to Nottingham every weekend, because in Nottingham they had like goths and they had skaters and they had like a variety of people. Yeah, that's probably why I'm here now still.
Yeah,
so I've always had that like association with it, of it being like an open and quite safe place.
Is there any magic in cross-dressing?
There's something unexplainable. I think that's what I think is like magic. It's like when something is just like beyond words, beyond like logic. Like the first time I put a wig on and I saw my reflection. I'd never like grown my hair long or anything before. I think it was like a grey wig that my friend had for a music video or something, and I borrowed it because I was having fun. Is either that or like a Halloween one?
I would like to note that the first time I saw you cross-dressing, you were dressed as
a witch.
A witch.
Yeah, let's talk about Halloween in a bit. That's a really interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah.
But I think it was just like something just clicked, and I've never felt that feeling before. And I was like, oh, it makes sense. I make sense. Like this is how I should look. This is like, regardless of everything, this is the right thing to do. And yeah, that was quite, maybe, I don't know, kind of feels recent, but it was probably like 5 years ago or something. But yeah, like Halloween. Yeah, let's talk about Halloween, because I think that connects.
I remember this particular Halloween, because I was at the end of a tail end of a terribly bad breakup, and I was really quite miserable, but I wasn't going to deny myself the pleasure of Halloween, so I decided to wear a sheet and was completely enclosed in a sheet, which as a ghost, which felt like the only way I could go out was to kind of completely cover myself up but be present, non-present.
Yeah.
And I just remember the absolute joy of your witch outfit, which was so fantastic. Incredible to watch from behind the cut-out holes of my John Lewis double sheet, standard double sheet that I had.
Yeah.
But that, yeah, I did, I don't know if it wasn't a surprise to see you dressed as a witch.
Mm.
I didn't know how much to put on it. It was Halloween.
Yeah.
But I did find it interesting that it was the one night of revelry and excitement and shifting.
Yeah, I think it's that, like, it's like the ultimate safe space. It's like, so there's no judgment. Everything makes sense because nothing makes sense. Like, anything goes, and someone's not reading you because you've not, like, done it for what you're trying to do very well. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, it's so, like, it's really a good place for, like, trying out things. The previous Halloween to that, I was, like, very closeted, cross-dressing in secret. My girlfriend didn't know anything about it. It was really, like, a really, yeah, dark time. But I really wanted to do something for Halloween. I've never, like, celebrated it or, like, done much. And I was like, I want to dress up like a witch. Really want to dress up like a witch. And no one was doing anything, and I was like, oh, I'll go try my friend's house and, like, watch a horror movie. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna watch a horror film dressed as a witch. I bought this, like, crap costume from Wilco's. But there was something, like, that feeling of, like, safeness or something. But contrary to that, I was talking to my friend. Do you know Women's History Museum
in London?
It's like a group of artists called Women's History Museum.
No, I don't think so.
My friend from Women's History Museum I was talking about this with her, and she's like, the work they do is about clothing and dressing, and it's very queer, but it's very, like, femme, and I don't know, it's really, really interesting. And she was like, no, Halloween's fucked up everything, because if you're, like, dressed over the top or whatever, anything, like, beyond, like, standard clothes, people are it's programmed people to think, like, the only place for that is Halloween, so you can't dress like that outside of Halloween. And I think she quite, like, it's very much a part of her, like, practice and being to, like, dress up daily. Like, her and her friends hate Halloween
because they're the one night of,
yeah, and it's like, that's the only time that you can dress up and da, 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 da. So I thought that was really interesting. Like, I hadn't thought of it like that. So for me, it was like, it's a really safe place, but actually, like, if you don't need that, if you're already, like, totally comfortable with, like, dressing up like whatever, being, like, fabulous every day, the world doesn't want that. They're like, is it Halloween? Like, she's like, constantly, all year, it's not Halloween. Oh, is it Halloween already? Like, and she's like, absolutely sick of it. Yeah, and I wonder, like, fuck, if it was like Halloween. This is why I wanted to do that party, like Halloween every month. Like a monthly Halloween party, and it should just happen throughout the year. And it's like, yeah, people want to dress up more than just once a year.
Thank you.
people who get to know us realize what we're doing is a very positive thing, that we're working with the energies of the earth, that we're very much tuned into a love consciousness, that we're seeking to do those kinds of things that religions all around the world have at their very essence, which is working with healing, working with love, working with achieving an inner balance and an inner communion with the divine.
So I'm Simon Costin, and I'm the custodian and director of the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic in Cornwall.
Let's talk about the museum then. So what is your role? What does that mean?
My role at the museum as director of it really is more custodial. I see myself as one of the individuals that has had the honour of being able to nurture and look after the collection. And I took over that role 5 years ago from Graham King, who was the previous director, who'd been there for 17-odd years. And prior to Graham was Cecil Williamson, who was the founder of the museum. And as of next year, the museum will have been in Boscastle for 60 years, so it's our big anniversary year.
Why is the collection important, or why is it so special?
The museum houses over sort of 3,500 objects, all relating to different aspects of witchcraft, magical practice, and the occult. So as a repository, it's immensely important, not only to the pagan community, but also to academics, because it's a social history museum, really, on one level. And on another level, it's a museum which cherishes the objects that have been used within magical practice, and as such is totally unique, really. I mean, you've got things like the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, which, funny enough, I was at a few days ago, which is an ethnographic museum. However, it does have several cases of things like divination tools and, you know, talismans and amulets and things like that. But there isn't really anywhere apart from the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic which has such a broad range of material, because there's also an archive, library, etc., etc. So as such, it's incredibly important.
And how come you became the custodian of it? Was it a personal interest? Was it an interest in the objects? Was it the is it witchcraft as a subject?
My interest, oh dear, it goes back a very long way. I mean, I can remember and still have a number of drawings that I used to do as a child, which always seem to involve witches or monsters of some sort, or fairy folk or whatever it was. There was always this interest in the sort of the otherness, the other worlds that run alongside the one that we exist in. So that interest also spread to things like folklore and British seasonal customs, seasonal events. So you'd have things which I used to witness as a child when we'd go on holiday, so with my parents, moments when a community becomes something completely other, a moment where they step out of their day-to-day being bank managers or an accountant or whatever it is, or a nurse, and they take on this otherness, I suppose it is. And for that moment, that community becomes something else. And for me, it was a moment of true magic when you saw a whole community transform itself in a way. So you have Padstow's May Day, you've got, you know, barrel burning in Ottery St Mary, the Abbots Bromley Horn Dance, all of those things, mumming plays, whatever it is, it's a moment where individuals become something else for a moment and let go of their day-to-day roles and responsibilities and step into this other way of being. And I was always fascinated by that. So it was sort of inevitable in a way that I'd be drawn towards magical practice, because magical practice, again, is about communing, if you like, or recognizing that there is a realm of being which is outside of the one that we normally experience. And I think any magical practitioner who begins to work with those sorts of energies, the first thing that gets transformed is themselves. Because by working with those things, you change yourself. You change the way you see the world, particularly, and the way you experience the world. And I found that really, really fascinating. Quite frightening at first, because when you start reading a lot of those books, and a lot of them talk about experiences that, of course, at that time you've never, as a child or growing up as a teenager, whatever, you've never experienced. So the minute you start looking at the world through this other lens, it can be quite scary. But then that's what was so thrilling and what drew me to it. And then, of course, it developed from there. Yeah. I mean, ritual practice is something that human beings have always done to make sense of the world, and also to mark major moments in our lives, like weddings and funerals and births and deaths, and all of those things involve a degree of ritual. I mean, if you look at how ritualistic weddings are, particularly if it's a church wedding, or a pagan hand fasting, it is a ritual. It's a sort of, it's a series of processes, that steps that are gone through, which are very formalized, and the same with a funeral. Not so much with births, but certainly with funerals and weddings. But yes, so I think ritual plays a part in all our lives. And if you choose to use ritual outside of those things, the prescribed uses of ritual practice, if you start using ritual in terms of magical practice, that takes you into a whole other realm. Which is, so again, very, very interesting, because it alters the way that you see things. And that's, as somebody who went to art school and is a creative person anyway, using ritual creatively within my work is often really rewarding. You know.
Could you talk about that? That
not sounds really.
Really interesting. No, we're not going down that.
The thing is, it's too kind of personal to explain.
I completely understand, yeah. Absolutely.
But it's one of those you'd have to be there, yeah, sort of, for it to make sense.
Yeah, the person and the sort of it's personal. And probably, if I answered that, quite boring if you did describe it.
From an outsider's, yes. Yeah.
It would feel a little bit like, oh, well, I thought there'd be something, you know, at least some kind of crazy potion or... something more exciting.
I think if most, you know, people have been brought up with Harry Potter, and so they're expecting lights coming out of the end of a wand and whatever it is, but those things are happening to you internally. They're not happening in the external world.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Going back then to the museum, it's important as a collection that shows that most quite recent social history. What do you think the future for the museum is, or how will it play a part in the future of kind of witchcraft, or the popularity of witchcraft, or people coming around to seeing the world through this different lens? Does the museum, will it play a part in that? Can it play a part in that?
Most definitely. I think that, I mean, the difference with the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic is that, and I've had this conversation with quite a few museum curators, is that most objects, when you put them in the context of a museum, divorced from their surroundings and the way in which they've normally been used or perceived or seen, kind of neuters them. It kind of strips away the personality of the object, if you like. Whereas with magical objects, a lot of them are still kind of fizzing. They're still kind of quite heavily charged, and it's that's a key difference, I think, with the museum's collection and most other collections. And it's something that I see often in ethnographic museums too, is that those objects still have a lot of energy around them. And whether you're susceptible to those things or not, I think it's still apparent. You know, I think a lot of people come to the museum who have no interest in particularly in magic, say, or whatever, but will often come and say that they found it very exhausting, or that they came away with a headache, or that we've had weird things with pieces of jewellery breaking. That's the running thing with the museum. Jewellery breaks in the museum, chains and necklaces, and some people complain about it, aren't very happy, and some other people are completely astonished. That
unchaining, freeing.
Yeah, I guess. Could look at it like that. I don't know what it is.
But necklace.
Yeah, exactly. Throw away that jewelry, cheap jewellery. But I think in terms of its importance, and it plays an ongoing role in terms of people who are exploring the magical will often come to the museum for research purposes. Because not only can you glean so much information from those objects themselves, but also they give you clues as to how you might evolve your magical practice. You could look at some of the folk charms and think, well, okay, I've never actually thought of that kind of side of magical practice. Or you could look at things that are to do with high ritual magic. Yeah, we've got Golden Dawn things, we've got, and you get, so it alters your magical path, I think, if you're interested in the occult to begin with. And that's why the museum's so important, because so many people come there, say they're, I don't know, Gardnerian Wiccan or something, and then they'll be opened up to all these other aspects of magical practice. And it does leave you changed, I think, when you leave that place, especially if you start using the library and the archive, because it's so rich.
My baby told me three times nice.
We are part of a whole. We are part of all of Mother Earth, and it's important to see that and to work in harmony with the other life forms. And by putting that thought there, if enough people held that image in their mind, real magic would start happening on the planet. People would start treating each other differently. They would start not only treating other humans differently, but plants and animals and the ground that we walk on, the air that we breathe, the water that we drink.
The arts in like London College of Fashion. I was doing like a fashion journalism master's, and this was my main project throughout the master's degree, Sabat magazine. So, and then my tutor was also like kind of casually like a bit interested in witchcraft, a bit interested in paganism, and a bit like he was interested in like horror movies, everything, but like he was very encouraging. So he was kind of like, you should do something that's niche, like that's much better than doing something like another fashion magazine or lifestyle magazine, or do something you're interested in. And yeah, sort of really, yeah, encouraged me to kind of take it to market. And yeah.
So how did Sabat come about then?
Well, I started, I was very visually interested in like 90s girl culture and like bedroom culture and Bikini Kill and that sort of thing, and also like kind of interested in the aesthetic of like 90s girl power witchcraft. Super superficial, it was kind of like a hunch, but like lots of my things are like a hunch. So it started out being more about that, and me sort of for my university, like asking myself, like, where are there real teenage witches? That's why we kind of had the Maiden issue as the first issue, and like we looked at it from this sort of like I guess like age, generation, phase of life perspective, because I started out looking for teenage witches, and I was like, where are they? Are they cool? Are they fashionable? And yes, they were, and they were on Instagram, and it took a little while to kind of to get to that, to realize that like they were actually like on social media, because first I went to Treadwells and I kind of talked to people, and I gained an understanding of like what being a practicing modern witch is from interviewing people. And then from then on I was like, but there has to be something that is like more aesthetic, because like again I'm a very visual person. And I think I was kind of like, people were being really lovely. It was like this kind of flow of like, someone said, oh, you should talk to this person, you should talk to this person, and everyone kind of wanted to talk to me. And I don't know like why they were so trusting, because like I was a university student who wanted to do a project, but they were all like giving me interviews and talking to me. And I got in touch with Faye, like Nix Turner. She's a sort of queer witch artist, photographer. She's American, but she was at the time in Glasgow, and I saw her like Instagram feed, and she ended up doing some art for Sabat. I interviewed her for the first Sabat, and I feel like from then on, like a lot of internet, social media, understanding doors opened for me. So I was just like, yeah, I went to LA to see a girl that she had like taken pictures of before, Segovia Emile. She's not as much online anymore, but she was this like poetry witch in LA, beautiful, amazing sort of aesthetic as well. And yeah, I think from that point I realized that was very much like, if a teenage witch exists today, she has an Instagram account and she's like sharing her rituals, she's sharing what she's doing. And yeah, it was like very like exciting.
magic is real. And I don't see it as supernatural, but very much natural.
I had no idea. I was sort of like, I just like, okay, embarrassing to admit, I had this like one fantasy that someone would like, that it would sell out and someone would sell a copy of it on eBay sometime. And then it happened and I was like, oh my God. Like that was like the level of my, and we printed like the first print run of the Maiden issue was like 1,000 copies. So it wasn't like, it's not a lot to sell out 1,000 copies. But for me, that was like the pinnacle, like that someone would just resell it on eBay ever. But no, it's been really great. It's like, I feel like we just hit like some sort of curve of like interest and both sort of mainstream interest, but also maybe that it was like more okay to be a little bit surface. Like it is more superficial naturally because especially the Maiden issue and like then the Mother issue is a little bit more considered and the Grown issue is quite dark and weird, but I think especially the Maiden issue was like me trying to figure out what is modern witchcraft, and it was a quite like a sort of blind search. Then that should appeal to people who are also just getting into it kind of makes sense, because like I was just getting into it. So, but I could never imagine like that it was so popular, and yeah, it's been really cool.
Jones and Freya Barlow. Additional music was by Jerry Southern, Phil Kieran, Mick Smiley, and Ursula the Witch from Disney's The Little Mermaid. This is episode 3 of 4 podcasts commissioned by Legion Projects for Waking the Witch, an exhibition looking at craft, ritual, and the land, and the ever-shifting archetype of the witch.
If it were only facts that mattered, man now knows more about himself than he has ever known, and yet somehow he believes in himself less. There is a gap between what we know and what we feel. Many find that the occult can bridge that gap. It can take us beyond ourselves, to the infinite.
It gives the gift of joy unto the hearts of men.